Shifting gears now, Brian Holland is a radio host, award-winning journalist and broadcaster. What no one knew was that though for 11 long years, Brian was deep inside the white supremacist and neo-Nazi movement, even became their standard bearer and presidential candidate in 2008. What did he learn about these organizations, and what did he do with that information that he acquired during those 11 years? As I said, Brian has got quite a secret to reveal. He's going to reveal it here tonight for the first time about those 11 years that he spent, his perilous journey into this disturbing world of white supremacy. And we'll get right into that after this on Coast to Coast AM. Brian Holland and I have been in sort of surreptitious contact for, oh, I guess close to a year now, emails back and forth, a couple of phone calls, and he's been telling me his story in bits and pieces, and it's a fascinating one. I mean, a glimpse into the murky world of the white supremacy movement. And, you know, I didn't know whether to believe him at first, but as I looked online and got other bits and pieces of information from him, it sure looks like there is enough that is confirmable to warrant a thorough interview and investigation. And as I mentioned, Brian has a pretty big secret that he's planning on releasing tonight for the first time. We'll get into that in a little bit, though. Brian, it's good to have you on the program finally.
Thank you, George. It's an honor to be with you.
Let's start this way. In reading some of the background material that you sent me, I was surprised to learn that as a young man, you were a liberal. I mean, you were way over on the left. I mean, literally a card-carrying commie and socialist, and then somehow you became a conservative. Talk to me about that transition.
I actually, when I was 18 years old, ran for city council in my hometown as a socialist candidate. George, I hear a lot of people say this when they get to our age, but I learned when I started working that socialism and liberalism didn't work. I remember looking at my paycheck as a teenager and wondering who all these people were that my taxes were going to. I think back then $3.35 an hour was the minimum, and the more I looked into it and the more I realized that there were people not working being supported by people that were working, the more I gravitated away from the left side of the road and stayed in the middle for a while, and I found myself as I grew, the more I grew, George, the more conservative I became.
There are a lot of people who become more conservative as they get older, but they don't become Nazis. So talk to me about how that transition works.
Well, I had always been a student of history, George, and was fascinated by the different forms of government around the world. Never considered myself a Nazi or a National Socialist, whichever way you want to go. They insist on being called National Socialist. I never understood how you got socialism and Nazism together, but I guess that's for different people to decide. But as a teenager, I was fascinated with World War II. Both of my grandfathers were in the war. I heard stories. Just became extremely fascinated with the European side of the conflict, and often wondered, was there more to look into there? As I looked into it, George, I got to know some folks that were in the white power movement of the 80s, which, as a journalist, you know, was a completely different movement in the 80s than it is right now.
Sure.
A whole different setup back then.
Skinheads?
Skinheads were just starting to grow at that time, and it was still mostly Klan. What you and I would probably call the old boys network, the cookouts and the natural light cans and things like that, you know. But I met some folks that introduced me to some other folks, and before I knew it, I was a public spokesman for an organization called the Confederate Knights of America. I think I was all of, 18 or 19 years old at the time. At the same time, considering myself a far-left socialist at the same time, George, I know it sounds silly, but wrapped up in the idea of being a part of something that you're capable of making a change in, basically.
Well, you mentioned it yourself that the combination of right wing and socialism doesn't seem to mix. But I mean, as I recall, that's the National Socialists. That was the name of Hitler's party, right?
Yes, yes, it was. I didn't at that age didn't fully grasp, as a lot of folks didn't fully grasp everything that National Socialism entailed at that age. You know, every political ideology, George, and again, as a journalist, you know this, but every ideology has points that would work. Unfortunately, when you mix people into anything, you get the fly in the ointment. Karl Marx's system looks great on paper. When you add human nature, it messes it all up, you know.
So, where were you living when this when you became involved with this Klan-like organization?
I'm from a town called Suffolk, Virginia, which is right outside of Norfolk in Virginia Beach, Virginia. I know everybody knows Norfolk, Virginia. I was actually living there. I was born and raised there until I was about, I guess, 21 or 22. I spent most of my life there, actually. But that's where I was. I cannot, for the life of me, George, recall exactly how I met the person's name was David, actually, who introduced me to the Confederate Knights. I cannot, for the life of me, remember how I met the guy. You know how some people in your life, you kind of just disappear in your mind. It's been a few years, unfortunately. But I was actually, at the time, still living at home with my family.
And so the Confederate Knights, I mean, that sure sounds like the Klan. Everybody had to know then that that's exactly what this was, or something pretty close to it, right?
They had a division that was designed for younger people, which is where they put me. I grew up in private school, George. You and I have talked a lot, as you said during the introduction. But I'm even as a teenager, I was a suit and tie kind of guy. And when the director of the organization at the time, his name was Terry Boyce. I believe he's passed away now. But when I met Terry, he liked my approach and liked my style. And of course, at the time, we're talking around the time of David Duke here, who, you know, we like to famously say he put the robe in the closet and took the three-piece suit out. Which is how he got accepted into so many homes back then. You remember those days.
Sure.
But my approach was basically the same. You know, tone the rhetoric down and approach the people that need to be approached. And that's what Terry liked about me. But the division they had for the younger folks was basically the skinhead type of folks, but it entailed people of all walks of life. You know, they wanted to attract the private school kids and the kids that wanted to go in the military and, you know, just anybody basically. These organizations, George, are looking for people that need a home, basically. They need to be accepted. And that was the plan. You know, they had a clean-cut private school kid that wore a tie everywhere he went, and that was me.
Well, talk to me about race. You mentioned that you were attracted to this initially because of what was happening with your paycheck, economic issues, I guess.
Yeah.
What are the conversations when you're at these cookouts or something about racial issues?
Everything to these folks is generally somebody else's fault. I never entirely felt that way. Tread this carefully, George. Being a private school kid, I was never exposed to what a lot of people are exposed to—the inner cities, the public schools. I had no idea. You know, I had read about the busing in the 70s. I didn't understand the big deal because we didn't have that problem. I think there may have been two or three minority kids with me in school the entire 12 years that I was in. You know, I mean, I had no clue that people felt the way these people felt. All I knew. I approached it, George, from the aspect of being proud of my heritage, which I still am, and I don't think that makes you a racist. I think it just makes you proud of where you came from. I support everybody's right to feel that way, of course, but you know, at these gatherings, anything that is wrong with society is automatically another racist fault. I never quite grasped that, even being involved with these groups. I used to think, well, Terry, if something is wrong with that, then why don't we try to fix it rather than sitting here drinking a beer and pointing at the other people? Wasn't a real popular opinion, but but it was. I thought it was a valid question, George.
I understand what you're saying, but there had to be, and we'll get into this later in detail as you rise through the ranks, but I mean, there had to be some kind of conversation that gave you pause, like, you know, what their plans are for this race or that race, or not just a matter of blame, but I mean, it goes beyond just sitting around talking, drinking beers and talking, right?
The Klan organizations of the 80s, George, were still the old line Klans. I mean, it was essentially a lower middle class social club is basically what the Klans were at that time. They had been gutted in the 60s and 70s by the Department of Justice. They had lost pretty much any organizational threat that they had at the time. I mean, there were, you know, like in any organization, there are lone wolves that you have to look out for, which I would learn later in life. When, as you said, when we get further into the story, I would learn the lone wolves are generally the ones you have to watch. But no, my experience with these Klan groups, George, was it was a whole lot of talking. And I didn't always like what I was hearing. Well, now, when I got further along in the movement and got involved with the other organizations, the rhetoric was much stronger. The rhetoric was much more dangerous, I learned. And I learned that there were more people in these other organizations, George, that were more than willing to take up the arms. And when they heard a leader say, this is what needs to be done, these organizations had the members that were more prone to do it. The Klan groups, you know, throw a burger on the grill and let's sit around and tell jokes about other races. That was pretty much my experience with the Klan groups early on.
Help me understand this then. As you become, at a young age, you become sort of a spokesperson or working in PR for these organizations, mm-hmm. and then you become a broadcaster, it would seem to me that that you'd have trouble getting a job as a broadcaster if you are publicly out as a front with these organizations.
My place with these organizations was not a well-advertised place. I did, for lack of a better term, George, corporate recruiting, I guess, if I met someone who would fit in, a business card and a brochure went in their hand. I didn't go to a lot of places for years. Matter of fact, probably until the late 90s, early 2000s, I didn't go anywhere where I had to speak in public. It was just a matter of this kid's clean cut, let him go, and if he sees somebody, he'll talk to him. Back then, and I kind of missed this, but back then, as you know, the internet wasn't what it is now. Now when someone applies for a broadcasting gig, you know, the first thing a program director does is Googles your name. Well, these days, it's a problem. 20 years ago, it wasn't so much a problem. And at the time, George, and I think you and I may have discussed this, but broadcasting was not my intention when I was 19, 20 years old.
So describe for me your rise in that industry, though, where you worked and how popular you became. I know you were syndicated a couple of times.
Twice, yes, sir. I kicked around, as you know this happens, I kicked around my home market, one, two, three, four stations, I believe. I was a morning drive host. I was a news director at an AM/FM combo. Was a weekend host a couple of times. Got a job at a brand new station that was positioning themselves as a conservative talk station. Got a midday job there, going against Rush, who of course is a premier program. I used to joke, you don't compete with Rush, you're just on at the same time as Rush, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like coast to coast, you know.
Yeah.
But while I was at that was a 10,000 watt station on 1650 on the dial, so you can imagine what kind of signal we had. It was one of the expanded bands. Of course, George and I are the only ones that know what that means. But from there, I actually got a network offer. Went to work for a far, George, I can't say far enough times, far-right network called Liberty Works Radio Network. I did their morning show with a Hall of Fame broadcaster named Ernie Davis. We were positioned basically where my point of view was accepted at the network. I think that's what they liked about me.
So you could talk about this stuff, the same kind of topics that you're looking into with your private organization.
Yes, I could very openly state where I stood politically and socially. However, they did draw the line at me endorsing the organizations, which of course, you know, in common marketing sense, hard to sell a spot when you're endorsing the Klan, you know.
And as you're on the air with these kind of shows, are you using code words? Are you pretty open about the whole thing, or is there a separate message going to people who are members?
I drew an audience based on the fact that I was basically the only member of the movement that had that type of positive media exposure. David Duke, of course, broke the doors down in 92 when he ran for the Republican presidential nomination. But even David, anywhere to this day, when you see David's name, he's former Klan leader David Duke. You know, he's never going to be anything else. I was fortunate where I wasn't tarnished by being a standard bearer for the movement. I was basically a guy on the air who happened to be friendly to the movement. And it was a wink, wink, nod, nod situation. The members of the movement knew where to listen to me, and that was basically my audience.
One of the notes you had sent to me indicated that there's a lot of money that's funneled into these organizations, Klan-type organizations, Nazi-type organizations from overseas. Who's sending it and why?
Mainly the neo-Nazi organizations are the recipients. The Klan groups, George, I think you and I may have emailed or discussed this, but the Klan groups are yesterday's news. They're not even a mainstream part of the movement anymore, for whatever that means. But European organizations for the neo-Nazi movement are huge. They're drawing 8, 10, 15,000 people to rallies in Europe for guys in uniforms wearing swastikas, George. So much so that, as I'm sure you know, there are several countries in Europe where it is actually illegal to wear the uniform or even discuss this in public because they're petrified of it. It's where it started at. I can cite, for example, David Duke, who lives in the Ukraine right now. David will speak in Russia or anywhere in the former Soviet Union, and David will draw 8,000 people to a public event. He's a rock star in Europe. The money is raised in Europe, goes through the United Kingdom, a couple of organizations there, one called the November 9th Society, N9S is what it's called. And there was a gentleman in the United Kingdom named Colin Jordan, who during the 1960s was the, the big grand poobah of the National Socialist revival in the United Kingdom. While George Lincoln Rockwell was working in the United States, Colin Jordan was working in the United Kingdom. When Colin retired, for lack of a better word, he became the liaison between the United States organizations and the European organizations. And there are literally, George, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year that funnel through the United Kingdom into the United States.
And what is done with that money?
That's a good question. I long questioned where that money was going. It obviously wasn't going into organization. Obviously wasn't going into any type of equipment. Now, there are organizations within the white supremacist movement that do own, say, record labels, which is, believe it or not, George, white supremacist music is a very hot product, believe it or not. There are probably 3 or 4 record labels that produce nothing but white supremacist music. There are magazines. Believe it or not, there are pinup calendars of white supremacist women. The internet radio networks. That's the only thing I can see that the money is being used for. And far be it from me to point any fingers, but I guess a few people probably do live a little better than what their income suggests they should.
There's no on-air regular radio station, AM, FM, that's a white supremacist station, is there?
No. David Duke, for years, had a local show out of Mandeville, Louisiana, where he lived, where he's from. As a matter of fact, his house is still there. But for years, he had a show on a fairly powerful AM down there and had sponsors and was actually making money off of it, George. And as you know, local radio, if you sell your own show, you're usually starving to death. Of course, in Louisiana, David Duke was David Duke. You know, everyone in Louisiana just overlooked the whole Klan thing. He was David Duke. But no, as far as an actual commercial radio station, no. I do know of a couple of low-power FMs. And, of course, the Internet is just packed with this type of stuff.
I guess the Internet, of course, has been a very valuable tool for these kinds of organizations. But it's also, and I want you to talk about it after we come back after the break, about how big it's gotten as a result of economic turmoil. Because I would imagine it's an opportunity for these kinds of organizations. People get angry. They're unemployed. They feel like they've been treated unfairly in comparison to maybe other races. And it becomes a recruiting tool, right?
Very much so, George, very much.
Well, we'll get into that because we're going to go to a break here in a second. And then I want to tell the folks about how you became a presidential candidate as we work toward revealing your secret agenda you are pursuing for a period of 11 years. We'll come right back with my guest, Brian Holland, here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Brian Holland about the years he spent inside white supremacy organizations. He even ran for president for one of those organizations back in 2008. When we return, we'll talk about that race and as well as the secret that he has not yet revealed about his 11 years inside those groups. Stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM. Brian Holland, one of our listeners, mentioned to me, emailed me, and told me that they refer to themselves as white nationalists as opposed to white supremacists. Is that an important distinction, and if so, why?
The white nationalist term, George, is another attempt to clean up a little with the public image. These folks became aware after David Duke became very aware of public relations and marketing. Unfortunately or fortunately, however you look at it, there are a few folks inside the movement that are educated enough to know that we need to change this, we need to tweak that, we need to get our message across. I think that's how I made the travel up the ladder, for lack of a better term, that I did, was being a broadcaster. I understood the public message. White nationalism is more of a, more along the lines of the survivalist movement, or the there are actually religions within the organizations. There's the Aryan Nations, which is the Church of Jesus Christ Creator. There's the World Church of the Creator. There's believe it or not, there are still Odinists out there from the old Viking religion. So white nationalism is a wee bit different than the National Socialist organizations, but yeah, you know, George, it's PR. You know, you can put a rose in a bowl of feces, and it's still a bowl of feces with a rose in it. You know, I mean.
So I mean, the suggestion that they're white nationalists, that they're not necessarily supremacists. They're not saying they're better than anyone. They just want to be treated as equally as everyone. That's really just putting a coat of paint on it.
I'm sure there are folks that feel that way. As I said earlier, I'm very proud of my heritage. I spent, good grief, George, probably 9 years doing my family tree, and got pretty far back. And I'm extremely proud of everything I found. That doesn't mean I hate anyone else, but I'm sure there are many people that do feel the way I feel. And you know, when I say about the movement itself, I don't mean to be derogatory about people that are just proud of being Irish, proud of being German. I'm very proud of my Irish heritage, my German heritage, but I don't particularly want to see anyone driven into the sea.
Talk to me about different organizations. You mentioned Aryan Nations religions within the movement. How many of the major organizations are there? How much coordination is there between them, and which one did you rise in?
The problem within the white supremacist, white nationalist movement, whatever you want to call it, the problem for those folks is there is no coordination. This group leader doesn't want to march with that group leader. This group leader makes fun of that group's uniforms. This group leader refuses to march with guys that carry swastikas. This group leader refuses to march with guys that carry Confederate flags. Fortunately, again, or unfortunately, George, they haven't figured out that if they just stop fighting, you know, there would be more of them. They haven't figured this out yet. There are dozens and dozens, probably scores of organizations, some of which I know of, George, that only have two or three members. And to them, they're still doing their part. And, you know, if that's what they believe, God bless them. The largest organization, the National Socialist Movement, NSM, is the organization that I became most prominent in. I went to a little town in Minnesota whose name, I'm very sorry, but the name of that town escapes me, George, was in the middle of nowhere. I never thought I'd get there. But I met with a gentleman named Jeff Scoop, who was a younger guy, younger than me. Nice-looking guy, clean cut. Looked like the guy next door that you would expect to take a welcome basket to. He was the head of this organization, which has been around since the early 70s, and I met with him. He was familiar with my work with other organizations. I was on David Duke's staff once or twice. I was with David at some pretty big events. But Jeff was familiar with my work and offered to create an entire division of his organization for me to operate. The main purpose of that division, George, was to reach out to the other organizations and say, hey, guys, you know, we're all on the same bus here. We kind of all need to get on the same road, you know. That was my main job with the National Socialist Movement. I was basically, my official title was National Staff Liaison. I dealt with the other organizations, and I also did basically what amounted to internal affairs. I made sure that the organization was operating by the book, for lack of a better term.
So this guy, Jeff Scoop, is how you pronounce it?
Mm-hmm. Jeff Scoop, yep.
And was his idea to sort of unite all these organizations?
He was wise enough. He had learned at the feet of some of the older guys, George, and he understood that if the movement was going to survive, they had to pull together. And when he ran that past me, I said, Jeff, you know, I've been screaming this for years. Any movement, whether it be the Communist Party or the Socialist Party, you know, if there are 14 different groups all saying the same thing, but they just can't get along, you're hurting yourself. I mean, that's true for any belief system. And when Jeff found out that I was like-minded, and because of my again, for lack of a better term, because of my suit and tie approach, I never wore a uniform, never did, refused to wear a uniform. Because of my approach, Jeff said, well, this is what we need to do. And he offered to create this entire division of the organization, gave me a staff, and I went about shaking hands and kissing babies.
So tell me about your liaison duties, the kinds of people that you encountered, the kinds of activities that maybe you were exposed to, what these other organizations were up to. You must have met a really interesting mix of people.
George, I met everyone from unemployed auto workers to doctors and lawyers that were involved with the movement. Met local TV hosts that did the municipal access TV shows. I met restaurant managers, school teachers, bankers. I mean, this movement attracts so many different types of people. I saw people that I felt genuinely were just concerned, and I saw people that I thought, wow, if they don't get this person off the street, something bad is going to happen. I saw the most disgusted I ever became was during the presidential run that we'll be talking about. I was campaigning in New Hampshire. I had done my campaign, my stump speech, and was listening to the other speakers talk about how other races were destroying America with drug use and drug trafficking and, you know, the whole master race spiel. And I go around the corner a few minutes later, and the guy that had just given the speech is standing in a circle of 13 uniformed Nazis passing a joint around. I mean, it's like any organization, George. You know, there's, I hate to say it, but there are good and bad people in every organization.
Well, I guess as you've described, sort of the gamut runs from people who are just angry about economic injustice or their perceived economic injustice to the other side, which there has to be some element in this of absolute outright racism and threats of violence. Now, what was the worst you saw in that regard?
I think the worst I saw in that regard was never really public. It was more of the behind-the-scenes talk. There are organizations that support the term in the movement is RAHOWA, R-A-H-O-W-A, racial holy war. There are those that are attempting to start a racial holy war. I think most famously in the early 80s, there was a guy named Bob Matthews who put together a little, I like to call him the A-team, put together a little A-team unit called the Order. The ones of those that weren't killed in a shootout with federal agents are serving pretty long prison sentences right now, but their plan was to rob banks to raise money to start this racial holy war. The bombing of the Murrow Federal Building in 93, I believe it was, many people think that Tim McVeigh was attempting to start a racial war with the bombing of the federal building. There are organizations that will seize any opportunity, and there are those that are much more violent in their rhetoric. Fortunately, I think, and I hate to be anticlimactic with this, but George, I think the majority of the movement is afraid of those people that publicly talk that way.
Is there some link to McVeigh that you know about that we don't know about?
Tim McVeigh, I know, had involvement with some organizations, and of course, George, it was such an obscure organization, I don't even remember the name of it, but if you'll remember back to the story, the truck that was used in the bombing, or you know, for those listening that are conspiracy-minded, the truck that was allegedly used in the bombing was satellite photoed, parked at a white supremacist camp a few days before the bombing. Now, the name of that organization escapes me because it was one of those off-the-wall, minuscule organizations. But we do know he had involvement with some white supremacist, white nationalist organizations. We do know that. That does not mean, I'm certainly not saying it was a concerted effort by the movement to bomb the federal building. I think a good portion of the people in these organizations, George, would run screaming with their hands in the air if somebody said, hey, let's go and blow up a building.
Tell me about your rise to become the standard bearer, the presidential candidate.
We had the grand plan to enter national politics. It came up in late 2007. The person who was selected had been in the movement since the 70s, was an older gentleman, and he began his campaign. idea was to present a national unified front that could be endorsed by other organizations. The person who ran, I'll call him John, his first name is John, the person who ran, John, is from South Carolina, had a falling out with Jeff Scoop, who was the head of the organization, and was asked to leave, basically. Well, of course, when he left, the endorsement was pulled, for all that's worth. The endorsement was pulled for the presidency. And we had, the NSM once a year has a national meeting in April, oddly on Adolf Hitler's birthday. That particular year, we were doing a rally and speeches and a march to the Capitol grounds in Washington, D.C. I was standing with Jeff while the other speakers were going. We were discussing the fact that, well, you know, it's 2008, it's April, we're going to have to sit out for four more years. Jeff looked at me, I looked at Jeff. I essentially, my exact words were, well, if you want me to, and pardon me for this, George, but I said, Jeff, if you want me to, what the hell? Just tell me and I'll go do it. So he said, well, go ahead. And when it was my turn to speak, this is not a very exciting story, I'm sorry, but when it was my turn to speak, I announced that I would accept the party's nomination for president. And we actually campaigned in several states, George. I had a campaign staff, got to speak in front of crowds as big as 100 folks. And I'm told by the official results that we received 561 votes. Which I don't know what scares me more, that they voted for a Nazi or that they voted for me. I don't know.
So what was the point of running for us and you or anyone for president? You know, you don't have a chance to win. What, just to get media attention? What?
Well, you know, I keep asking Ron Paul that too, but he won't answer me. The the point was that we could get the message out. We could present to the public the fact that, hey, you know, we're not all toothless baseball bat carrying, everybody hating people, you know, that we're the average people from all walks of life, doctors, lawyers. I was an English major in college. I didn't finish, but, you know, I still was an English major. I was a quote-unquote everyday guy who was a pretty recognized broadcaster in some parts of the country. So, you know, the idea was this is an opportunity to show people what we aren't. It was basically a campaign to educate, George.
And a recruitment tool.
Oh, yeah, very much. Yes, sir. We recruited heavily. The campaign events drew a lot of folks. I remember campaigning in Portland, Oregon, George, at a shopping mall, shaking hands and, you know, being as Southern charming as I could be. I actually talked to three or four African-American voters who said, okay, tell me what you're about. And I gave them my economic spiel, you know, what we need to do to save the economy. I gave them my, I'd like to close the borders for this period of time to get a handle on illegal immigration from everywhere in the world. And I remember one, he was about 35, African-American guy with his wife. He shook my hand. He said, you know what? You have totally changed my opinion overall of what you're doing out here. I said, well, I appreciate that. You know, I always, George, opened my stump speeches with the line, this is not about hate. This is not about being better. This is about the survival of the United States of America. And I believe, I turned a lot of people in the movement off because I believe wholeheartedly that every race has the right to survive.
You weren't radical enough for them.
I think that was a big problem. Yeah, the some of the hardliners saw me as a little soft. I got referred to a lot as one of my favorite names that I heard being called was like Diet David Duke. I guess could be a compliment or a bad thing. I don't know. But, yeah, I wasn't hate-filled enough. I wasn't the guy with the megaphone screaming white power. You know, I was the guy with the microphone saying, well, if you'll give me 5 minutes, I'll tell you how I'm going to cut taxes and not rack up debt.
Well, it just sounds like you're doing the same thing that all these major politicians do, and that's modifying your position to tell people what they want to hear to make your true feelings less obvious, I guess.
That was the plan, George. Jeff Scoop and I got together, based it on the David Duke campaign from 92, and said, okay, my job, they looked at me and said, Brian, your job is to get them in the door. Once you get them in the door, you go back out there and get another group, and we'll take care of the people that came in the door.
As you travel around the country and you say, hey, I'm going to be here and make a speech, is there media coverage? What? And if so, what was the attitude of the local media coverage? Also, do you have other organizations show up, people to picket your appearances?
We actually were pretty well received by a lot of the organizations in the movement. Of course, anywhere the National Socialist movement went, we were met with barrages. I mean, hundreds of protesters that attempted to shout us down, attempted to shut down the rallies. Folks that were, in favor of pro speech as long as they agreed with it, which I never quite understood. The majority of our problems came from other pro-white organizations that just didn't like what we were doing. So, they would stir up as much trouble as possible. Of course, we had the communists would show up. Maybe I'm a little out of the loop, but I still call some of these folks the hippies. The occupier types that are complaining that they don't have a job, but they won't go get one. As far as the local media goes, we got a what I call a novelty coverage, George, like any fringe candidate would. The best coverage I actually got was in Omaha, Nebraska, when a local Fox affiliate came out and did about a 20-minute interview with me. Real nice young lady. She even asked me, she said, "Well, you don't look like a Nazi. What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm not sure how you look like a Nazi, but I can tell you what I'm doing, And I thought that was the most fair coverage we received.
Do you have, did the organizations have secret allies in media and in government, people who sympathize with the cause, even the more extreme elements of the cause, but just don't admit it in public?
The media, not so much, George. The media, as you and I are probably aware, and not to sound conspiratorial, but the vast majority of broadcasters are liberal Democrats. I don't think that's a big secret. All you've got to do is watch the news to see that. But there aren't so many that in the media willing to even be nice to us just because of the stigma that it attaches, which is perfectly understandable. I mean, I of all people am aware of that at this point. As far as Are you sure you want to get into the
Well,
political sphere here?
maybe we'll think about the second half of that, because
Thank
we
you.
need to reveal your secret before we get into some of the allies. And I have to think about it anyway, because you have some names to name.
Sir.
Anyway, I guess so at the end of the presidential campaign, was it worth it, the effort you put into it? Did it work as a recruiting tool?
Recruiting-wise, yes, George, it did. It did wonders for the organizations, and it brought together, from the organization standpoint of view, from the movement standpoint, it brought together a lot of folks that I never would have thought would be in the same room together as far as the movement went. Folks that hadn't, for lack of a better term, again, that hadn't done business together in years because they disagreed on how to do it. I think we showed that this can be done. And it will be done, and we were the first to do it, which is basically why it was done, to show the other organizations, while you're sitting there sniping at everybody else, look what we're doing. Recruiting-wise, it was phenomenal. I would guesstimate, and I'll, of course, when we do the reveal, I can tell you how I know these figures, but there are probably 10 to 12,000 active members of the National Socialist Movement, probably 20 to 30,000 supporters that send in donations and things.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, when we come back, we'll go ahead and tell what your secret agenda was. We're going to take a break now with our conversation with Brian Holland, talking about the white nationalist, white supremacist movement.